Yeah, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in India Wednesday following meetings in Islamabad with Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahid Khasan Abbasi amid concerns Pakistan isn't doing enough to end the harboring and support of terrorists. Tillerson publicly sought to emphasize the positive in the bilateral relationship.
Pakistan's important, as you know, regionally to the U.S. Security relationships. It's so important regionally to our joint goals of providing peace and security for the region and providing opportunity for greater economic relationships as well.
Mr. Abbasi insisted Pakistan is committed to the war against terror, adding it has produced results. RAND Corporation analyst Rafiq Dusani said Pakistan, which views India as its greatest existential threat, supports insurgencies that it views as countering New Delhi's actions in both Kashmir and Afghanistan.
America is not much concerned about what happens in Kashmir as long as it doesn't lead to a nuclear war between the two countries. But with American troops and interests in Afghanistan, this is of great concern.
Tillerson reportedly called on Pakistan to increase efforts to eradicate militants and terrorists operating within the country as a way to facilitate peace and stability in the region. Mr. Abbasi linked that objective to resolution of Pakistan's territorial dispute with India in Kashmir. In Kenya, the sound of political unrest. Thousands of opposition supporters marched in Kisumu to election board offices ahead of Thursday's scheduled presidential election rerun. Opposition leader Raila Odinga boycotting the vote, charging election officials are not capable of ensuring a free and fair vote. Late Tuesday, the bodyguard of the deputy chief justice was shot and wounded. Judges have been under threat since nullifying the August 8 vote. This is VOA News. Russia Tuesday used its veto of the UN Security Council to block a resolution extending the mandate of the investigators probing chemical weapons attacks in Syria. Michelle Sisson is the deputy U.S. UN ambassador.
The United States deeply regrets that one member of this council vetoed this text, putting political considerations over the misery of Syrian civilians who have suffered and died from the use of chemical weapons.
The investigating team is expected to make its report public Thursday that could identify those responsible for a deadly April 4 attack in the rebel-controlled town of Khan Sheikhoun in southern Idlib province. Russia, which backs the Syrian government, has suggested the attack was the result of a ground-based bomb, not an air raid. The Russian ambassador sought to postpone Tuesday's vote until the report's release, calling the vote an effort to embarrass Moscow. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman announced Tuesday creation of a $500 billion plan to build a business and industrial zone to be powered exclusively by renewable energy and covering more than 26,000 square kilometers. During a three-day business conference in Riyadh, the prince also pledged a more moderate and open Saudi society. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal said it reflects two changing realities.
One, the fall in oil prices or the moderation in their increase has tended to create a situation where economic balance and maintenance of what you may call a rentier state has become more and more difficult, number one. Number two, which is even more important, is that over time there has been a major demographic change.
He said Saudi society is becoming radically younger and more exposed to Western influence. The decision follows last month's announcement that women currently barred from driving will be allowed to do so beginning next June. A day after President Xi Jinping's political philosophy was enshrined in the Communist Party Constitution, the country's decision-making Politburo Standing Committee, currently seven members, is to be unveiled later Wednesday. Observers will be watching to see how many Xi loyalists will be named. The late renowned German-born Nobel physicist Albert Einstein's theory on happy living handed to a hotel bellboy in Tokyo on his way to collect his Nobel Award in 1922, Tuesday fetched $1.3 million at a Jerusalem auction. Gail Wiener is the CEO of Winners Auctions and Exhibitions.
Einstein is a worldwide personality. It's somebody that interests not just scientists. Basically, there is no kid in the world, I guess, that doesn't know who's Albert Einstein.
Einstein, who discovered the theory of relativity, simply wrote, "A calm and modest life brings more happiness than the pursuit of success combined with constant restlessness." The 15-nation West African bloc ECOWAS said it failed to reach agreement on creating a regional common currency by 2020, an idea that has been discussed for decades. It was aimed at replacing the CFA franc. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, October 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, continues her visit to three African countries today.
The United States very much sees Africa as a very important part of the world. We see great opportunities in Africa. We see challenges in Africa, but we want to support and help in those situations.
A Nigerian official sheds light on the death of four U.S. soldiers in Niger. One of the candidates in Liberia's October 10th presidential election denies he is being pressured by the Economic Community of West African States to drop his claim of election fraud. A new report says South Sudan is the most expensive place in the world to buy food. And Togo's opposition parties say they are disappointed in Gambia's foreign minister's comments.
We notice that Gambia politician or the Minister of Foreign Affairs knows very well what he's talking about. And it has been a great disappointment to hear that he did withdraw what he said earlier.
Kojo Delava is the Secretary General of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change Party. More than 130 Somali refugees are repatriated from war-torn Yemen, and ending child marriage could be economic boost for Western Central Africa. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, says Africa's violence and humanitarian disasters could spread into larger security threats to the United States. In order to stem the growing conflicts, the U.S. envoy is traveling to South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo in one of the first visits to the continent by a senior member of the Trump administration. Salma Abete and Eskander Frey compiled this report as narrated by Salem Solomon.
President Donald Trump has said little about Africa since taking office, but the killing of four U.S. soldiers during an ambush by the Islamic State-affiliated fighters in Niger earlier this month has focused attention on Washington's expanded military presence and counterterrorism operations against militants in Africa. After meetings on Monday with Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn and a senior African Union official, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, told reporters she hoped this was the beginning of a stronger relationship with the EU and African partners.
The United States very much sees Africa as a very important part of the world. We see great opportunities in Africa. We see challenges in Africa, but we want to support and help in those situations. But most importantly, we want to see how we can partner together, whether that is through economic development, whether it's through strategic practices, whether it's through political solutions.
Haley said she also plans to meet with South Sudan President Salva Kiir and Congolese President Joseph Kabila to deliver a strong message that their governments need to stop making the work of aid workers and peacekeepers more difficult.
Our goal is that we should all have one voice, and one voice is we have to see peace in South Sudan. We have to see that women are being taken care of. We can't see any more deaths. We can't see any more famine. We've got to start seeing the situation get better, and I think that the pressure is only going to continue until President Kiir makes a difference in that area.
South Sudan plunged into conflict in December 2013 after a dispute in the capital, Juba, between the forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and his deputy at the time, rebel leader Riek Machar. Haley said the possibility of freezing U.S. aid to South Sudan with the hope it would expedite the peace process must be viewed carefully.
When you look at South Sudan, you have to really think hard before you pull U.S. aid, because President Kiir doesn't care if we pull U.S. aid. He doesn't care if his people suffer. And that's the concern we have, is we don't know that that will make a difference by pulling U.S. aid or not. That's a conversation we will have, and we will try and see exactly what will move President Kiir.
Just to the southwest, the Democratic Republic of Congo has been in turmoil since the 1990s. The DRC has never witnessed a democratic, peaceful transfer of power. Instead, this mineral-rich country in the heart of Africa has been plagued by dozens of armed groups vying for power and control, with rape used as a weapon of war and children recruited as soldiers. Ambassador Haley said that the U.S. was hoping that President Joseph Kabila would do the right thing according to the DRC's constitution and has free and fair elections sooner than later as his legacy. Salem Solomon, for Skanderfereu, in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, VOA News.
A Nigerian government official says the body of U.S. Army Sergeant Lad David Johnson was retrieved later than the bodies of three other U.S. troops killed by militants in Niger on October 4th because he had remained on the front line while the others retreated under heavy fire. Risa Al-Bulla, a high-ranking government official and a former Tuareg rebel chief, told VOA that Johnson died at the location where the attack on a U.S. Nigerian reconnaissance mission began. As viewer Zlatika Hook reports, there are still many unanswered questions regarding the deadly Niger incident.
Johnson's widow has many questions regarding her husband's death near the village of Tongo Tongo in southwestern Niger.
Why it took them 48 hours to find my husband? Why couldn't I see my husband? I don't know what's in that box. It could be empty for all I know.
Some U.S. lawmakers also have questions about the circumstances in which four U.S. troops were killed and why it takes so long to get the answers. A top U.S. general said Monday the investigation is ongoing.
We're trying to balance the need to do this quickly with the need to make sure that it's accurate, and I think we will certainly err on the side of accuracy.
Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said a group of 12 U.S. Green Berets and about 30 Niger troops were attacked in ambush by about 50 militants. The soldiers were returning from a reconnaissance mission and did not expect contact with the militants, he said.
During a firefight, two U.S. soldiers were wounded and evacuated by French air to Niamey. And that was consistent with the casualty evacuation plan that was in place for this particular operation. Three U.S. soldiers who were killed in action were evacuated on the evening of 4 October. And at that time, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson was still missing. On the evening of 6 October, Sergeant Johnson's body was found and subsequently evacuated.
Dunford said that U.S. or French or Nigerian forces remained in the area at all times until Johnson's body was recovered, tacitly denying suggestions that the missing soldier might have been abandoned. VOA learned from a high-ranking official in Niger that Johnson remained on the front line after the others had retreated. Dunford said investigators are looking into why Johnson got separated from the rest of his group and other details of the incident. The U.S. military chief also addressed complaints by lawmakers in both parties directed at the Pentagon and the White House for the scarcity of information regarding the ambush.
If the Congress doesn't believe that they're getting sufficient information, then I need to double my efforts to provide them with information.
No group has claimed responsibility for the ambush near Niger's border with Mali, but U.S. officials say the attack with small arms fire and rocket-propelled grenades was likely carried out by a local group linked to Islamic State. Zlatica Hook, VOA News, Washington.
A member of Togo's opposition said they are disappointed to know that the Gambian Foreign Ministry has retracted an earlier statement allegedly made by Gambian Foreign Minister Usainu Dabo, in which he allegedly called on Togolese President Faure Gnassingbé to immediately resign. Togo's opposition political parties have been holding protests, calling on President Gnassingbé to respect a two-term presidential term limit and step down. In a statement Tuesday, the Gambian Foreign Ministry said it was up to the Togolese people to find a solution to what is largely an internal affair. Kojo Delava is Secretary General of Togo's main opposition, the National Alliance for Change Party. He says the Gambian government, having experienced 22 years of dictatorship under Yahya Jammeh, should have stood firm with the Togolese people.
The first statement was highly appreciated among opposition and among the people of Togo because it's encouraging, it's a sound declaration, and we notice that Gambia politician or the Minister of Foreign Affairs knows very well what he is talking about because his country has to fight also to free the people of Gambia from dictatorship. So we understood that this man is supporting our struggle right here in Togo. And it has been a great disappointment to hear that he did withdraw what he said earlier. But we take this as diplomatic behavior. discussing on the good relationship between Gambia and Togo. This is what in French we call a langue de bois between two countries. And we wanted more head of state in our sub-region to have a clear position to make pressure on the government so that the Togolese head of state can step down as soon as possible.
I have a statement in front of me from the U.S. State Department in which it says that the United States is deeply concerned about rising levels of violence and restrictions on freedom of expression and assembly in Togo related to the protest over proposed constitutional reforms. We call on the government of Togo to uphold its citizens' human rights, notably their freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and to ensure that all those arrested during demonstrations are afforded the right to due process. What do you make of this?
We do welcome this statement, and we thank the U.S. authorities to make this recommendation. This is not surprising, because I can remember that U.S. ambassador in Togo used to raise this point here in Togo, recommending the Togolese government not to forbid people to demonstrate, not to impeach people to freely express what they think, and to preserve freedom in the country. And we want the international community to support and to make sufficient pressure in the Togolese government so that it can let people freely demonstrate and express their thinking.
Kojo Delava is the Secretary General of Togo's main opposition, the National Alliance for Change Party. You are speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. Today is Wednesday, October 25th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. One of the candidates in Liberia's October 10th presidential election has described as gossip reports that he was summoned by some West African leaders to get him to drop his claim that the October 10th election was marred by massive fraud. Charles Bromsky of the Liberty Party took third place in the final results of the first round vote. His party has filed a complaint to the National Elections Commission alleging massive fraud, gross irregularities, and a violation of the Constitution and the electoral laws of Liberia. Bromsky said the runoff election, scheduled for November 7, should hold until his claims are investigated. He is currently in Ghana's capital, Accra. He denies that ECOWAS leaders are trying to pressure him to drop his claims.
Well, Jimmy, you know me. Who could possibly pressure me? I don't think anyone would attempt to do that. We have not had an election in Liberia. What happened on October 10th was such a tragedy for our country and our people. If it wasn't so bad, it would be funny. How can one talk about an election when we have now discovered someone in President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's office was arrested with neck materials, including a machine that he used to print our voter registration cards? We now know that the ballots were printed in Beirut, Lebanon. The ballots had no serial numbers on any of them. As a result, there was no accountability in the system. People did not know how many ballots were taken to any polling place, how many ballots were taken out. The National Election Commission itself published a polling and counting manual in which they had said every polling officer should have used a worksheet. Not a single one was used, could not have been used, because there was no serial number on the ballots. The worksheet required that you show the beginning serial number of ballots and the ending serial numbers. You had a situation where thousands and thousands of Liberians didn't get to vote because their names were said not to be in the voter registration list. This whole thing about election on October 10 was a big joke, my friend.
So you have drafted a complaint. Did you already file that complaint to the Elections Commission?
I filed a complaint on yesterday. Today, the national chairman of the Liberty Party wrote the Election Commission requesting them to stay the second round because it makes no sense for us to be pursuing a case while the process for a second round is going on. I mean, we have alleged violation of the Constitution of Liberia, violation of the election laws and other laws, massive fraud and irregularities. As you may know, even the vice president who made it to the, who they said made it to the second round, he himself had indicated that he agrees with Liberty Party, that there was massive fraud. My friend, nothing good can come out of evil. The time of the Liberian people have been wasted. We're looking forward to a rerun of the elections.
You are in the sub-region. The question is that you were summoned there in the sub-region by some ECOWAS leaders to either get you to drop the complaint or to pressure you, or to some people say they are trying to meddle in the Liberian elections. So let me ask you once again, is ECOWAS pressuring you to drop your complaint or to do otherwise?
That's not true. As I said to you, Jimmy, I'm in Accra visiting your friends. You know me personally. No one pressurizes me, and no one will do that. People who know me, they know the kind of person I am. I am a man of principle. I'm a person who loves my country. I have shown that over the years. This whole thing about contesting the election, it's not about Charles Walker Brumskin. But at some point in time, I will have to answer to my grandchildren where did I stand? Did I stand on the side of the Liberian people, or was I just doing this for a job for myself? So you can rest assured that we are in this to ensure that the rights of the people that have been violated will be restored, that people will be allowed to exercise their constitutional rights.
What do you say to anybody who will ask you or who will say to you that, Mr. Brumskin, you came, I think, third in the final results, that even if there were massive irregularities, they would not affect your results?
Two things. You know, Jimmy, this is my third time participating in presidential elections. Two times I was said to have lost. I raised no issue. This time, the issues are being raised because of the massive the violation of the constitutional laws of Liberia in the interest of the Liberian people.
Charles Brumskin, the presidential candidate of Liberia's Liberty Party. He was speaking with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. A new study by the World Food Program and MasterCard compares the relative prices of food around the world to average income. The report finds that South Sudan is the most expensive place in the world for food, with the average meal costing around $320 compared to the purchasing power of someone in New York. An editor of the report, World Food Program spokesman Andre Vornik, talked to Ricky Stryak about some of the most expensive places in Africa to eat.
Clearly, the more a country finds itself in conflict, the more expensive food will be. This is because conflict disrupts food systems, food markets, supply chains, so people really find themselves in great difficulty to feed themselves. So we've calculated, for example, that in South Sudan, which is really our most extreme number, it would cost, if you were a New Yorker and if you were to pay as much as a South Sudanese person pays in relation to their income, you would pay something like $320 for the most basic, simple plate of food. Then after that, in second position, we have Northeast Nigeria. That too, we have the Boko Haram conflict, which is ravaging that country, ravaging the agricultural sector, destroying the markets. There too, you would pay something like $200 relative to your income for a simple plate of food.
So one of the things that the report highlights, these problems are systemic. It's not necessarily just about having access to food. It's about infrastructure, roads, things like that, which is interesting, but also makes it seem like how can places like South Sudan get better when the problem runs so deep?
It's true that what makes food expensive is not, if you like, the lack of it. It's the way it's wasted, the way it's maldistributed. What happens, if you like, along the long pathway that runs from the soil where the food is grown to your stomach, if you like, where the food is digested. So this means that if people don't have access to, first, if they're kept away from their fields, then if they don't have productive farming techniques, then if they can't store the food, then if they can't get the food to market, if the markets malfunction, the food can't get delivered, the food can't get sold, and so on, then this creates a whole chain of difficulty and challenges, which ends up in food being extremely expensive. Now, what can you do about it? Of course, in principle, you need to end conflict and instill better governance in general. But what you can do is also work on resilience, for example, to climate threats. You can work with communities of farmers to give them training, improve their access to refrigeration, cut food waste. You can work to aggregate wholesalers so that, for example, where you would have a very disparate system of food distribution and food purchases, you could aggregate that in order to obtain better prices. You could try to train smallholder farmers so that they get better, more productive farming techniques. You can help cut waste. You can aggregate the production of smallholder farmers so that they get better prices for their produce and better access to markets. You can work to make markets more efficient and so on. So even if you like, if you have kind of this drumming background music of conflict and difficulty, you can intervene on a small scale to make food more accessible.
That was Andre Vornik, a spokesman for World Food Program. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Rome, Italy. In a joint operation funded by the United States, the UN Migration and Refugee Agencies have repatriated 134 Somali refugees from war-torn Yemen. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where both agencies are based.
A refugee boat carrying 73 men and women and 61 children left the Yemeni port of Aden on Monday and is to arrive Tuesday at the Somali port of Berbera. It is the third voluntary return of Somalis organized by the International Organization for Migration and UN Refugee Agency since September. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says some previous efforts have had to be suspended during the past few years because of the risks involved in organizing an operation such as this in a war-torn country.
Despite security difficulties there and the fact of sort of divided authorities, we were still able to get into an area around Aden that hasn't always been accessible to humanitarian aid groups and manage this transport.
The UN Migration Agency reports the Somalis had come to Yemen in search of a better life, got caught up in the conflict, and often were subjected to abuse by smugglers. The IOM began organizing the voluntary returns in November 2016. Since then, the agency has helped 1,845 Somalis return home. Millman tells VOA Somali refugees receive a reintegration package to help them restart their lives when they arrive home. He says the refugees often receive a grant of $1,100 so they can start a business, buy a cow, or invest in some other form of livelihood. He says that acts as a big inducement for refugees to voluntarily return.
It's a strong sweetener because the stigma of going abroad and failing is so great that we find this is a very effective way of lubricating, I guess is the best word, this process.
Millman says the cash grant ends up being less expensive for the donor than the cost of keeping a refugee or migrant in detention in Europe. He says the repatriation project is funded by a $4.4 million donation from the United States. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Wednesday, October 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I am James Botte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good Wednesday.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at Kenya's opposition protest and election confusion as the nation prepares for a repeat presidential vote. Citing irregularities, Kenya's Supreme Court nullified the results of the August 8th presidential poll. Understanding Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.